Microchips and plastic from David Hawthorne's childhood. They spiraled around the central golden tower, the city's tallest, weaving their way between the transparent walkways, playing Peter Pan and Tinkerbell. Pierre had long ago given up arguing with Kate about the elaborate routes she chose for entering the reconstruction. She ran this peephole on the city out of her own time, and she controlled access to the environment completely. He could either put up with her rules or stay away altogether, and the whole point of being here was to please her. They alighted on the paved square outside the town hall's main entrance. Pierre was startled to recognize one of the fountains as a scaled-up version of Malcolm Carter's demonstration for his algorithmic piggyback tricks. A cherub wrestling a snake. He must have noticed it before. He'd stood on this spot 100 times, but if so, he'd forgotten. His memory was due for maintenance. It was a while since he'd increased the size of the relevant networks, and they were probably close to saturation. Simply adding new neurons slowed down recall, relative to other brain functions, making some modes of thought seem like swimming through molasses. A whole host of further adjustments were necessary to make the timing feel right. The Elysians had written software to automate this tuning process, but he disliked the results of the versions they'd shared with each other, and hence made accessible to him, so he'd written his own, but he'd yet to perfect it. Things like table legs kept getting in the way. The square wasn't empty, but the people around them all looked like puppets merely strolling past. The city's owners were already inside, and so Kate's software, which spied on the true city and reconstructed it for the two of them, was carrying most of the burden of computing the appearance of their surroundings, now officially unobserved. He took Kate's hand, and she allowed it, though she made her skin feel as cold as marble, and they walked into the hall. The cavernous room was about half full, so some 8,000 Elysians had turned up for the meeting. Pierre granted himself a brief bird's-eye view of the crowd. A variety of fashions and clothing, or lack of it, and body type were represented, certainly spanning the generations. But most people had chosen to present in more or less traditional human form. The exceptions stood out. One clique of fourth-generation Elysians displayed themselves as modified Babbage engines. The entire hall couldn't have held one of them to scale, so portions of the mechanism poked through into their seating allocation from some hidden dimension. Ditto for those who turned up as Searle's Chinese Rooms, huge troops of individual humans or human-shaped automatons, each carrying out a few simple tasks, which together amounted to a complete working computer. The components seated in the hall were Cali-armed blurs, gesticulating at invisible colleagues with coded hand movements so rapid that they seemed to merge into a static multiple exposure. Pierre had no idea how either type of system collected sound and vision from its surroundings to feed to the perfectly normal Elysians these unwieldy computers were presumably simulating. As the end result of all their spinning cogs and frantic hand movements, or whether the people in question experienced anything much different than they would have if they'd simply shown that standard physiological model to the world. Pretentious fancy dress aside, there were a smattering of animal bodies visible, which may or may not have reflected their inhabitants' true models. It could be remarkably comfortable being a lion, or even a snake, if your brain had been suitably adapted for the change. Pierre had spent some time inhabiting the bodies of animals, both historical and mythical, and he'd enjoyed them all, but when the phase was over, he'd found that with very little rewiring, he could make the human form feel every bit as good. It seemed more elegant to be comfortable with his ancestral physiology. The majority of Elysians apparently agreed. 8,000 was a typical attendance figure, but Pierre could not have said what fraction of the total population it represented. Even leaving out Callis Shaw and Ryman, the three founders who'd remained in their own private worlds, never making contact with anyone, there might have been hundreds or thousands of members of the later generations who'd opted out of the core community without ever announcing their existence. The ever-expanding cube of Elysium had been divided up from the outset into 24 ever-expanding oblique pyramids, one for each of the 18 founders and their offspring, and 6 for common ventures, such as Permutation City itself, but mostly Planet Lambert. Most Elysians, or at least most who used the city, had chosen to sync themselves to a common time rate. This standard time grew steadily faster against absolute time, the ticking of the TVC cellular automaton's clock. So every Elysian needed a constantly growing allocation of processors to keep up. But Elysium itself was growing even faster, leaving everyone with an ever larger surplus of computing power. Each founder's territory was autonomous, subdivided on his or her own terms. By now, each one could have supported a population of several trillion living by standard time. But Pierre suspected that most of the processors were left idle, and he had occasionally daydreamed about some fifth-generation Elysian studying the city's history, getting a curious hunch about Malcolm Carter, and browbeating one of the founders into supplying the spare computing resources of a near-empty pyramid to scan the city for stowaways. All of Carter's ingenious camouflage and the atom-in-a-haystack odds, which had been their real guarantee against discovery, would count for nothing under such scrutiny, and once their presence was identified, they could easily be disinterred, assuming that the Elysians were generous enough to do that for a couple of petty thieves. Kate claimed to believe that this was inevitable in the long term. Pierre didn't much care if they were found or not. All that really mattered to him was the fact that the city's computational infrastructure was also constantly expanding to enable it to keep up with both the growing population and the ever-increasing demands of Elysian standard time. As long as that continued, his own tiny fraction of those resources also steadily increased. Immortality would have been meaningless, trapped in a machine with a finite number of possible states. In a finite time, he would have exhausted the list of every possible thing he could be. Only the promise of eternal growth made sense of eternal life. Kate had timed their entrance into the replay perfectly. As they settled into empty seats near the back of the hall, Paul Durham himself took the stage. He said, "Thank you for joining me. I've convened this meeting to discuss an important proposal concerning Planet Lambert." Pierre groaned. "I could be making table legs, and you've dragged me along to Attack of the Killer Bees, Part 1093. Kate said, "You could always choose to be glad you're here. There's no need to be dissatisfied." Pierre shut up, and Durham, frozen by the interruption, continued. "As most of you will know, the Lambertians have been making steady progress recently in the scientific treatment of their cosmology. A number of teams of theorists have proposed dust and gas cloud models for the formation of their planetary system, models which come very close to the truth. Although no such process ever literally took place in the Autoverse, it was crudely simulated before the launch to help design a plausible ready-made system. The Lambertians are now zeroing in on the parameters of that simulation." He gestured at a giant screen behind him, and vision appeared. Several thousand of the insect-like Lambertians swarming in the air above a lush blue-green meadow. Pierre was disappointed. Scientific treatment of their cosmology sounded like the work of a technologically sophisticated culture, but there were no artifacts visible in the scene. No buildings, no machines, not even the simplest tools. He froze the image and expanded a portion of it. The creatures themselves looked exactly the same to him as they'd looked several hundred thousand Lambertian years before, when they'd been singled out as the species most likely to give rise to civilization. Their segmented, chitinous bodies were still naked and unadorned. What had he expected? Insects in lab coats? No, but it was still hard to accept that the leaps they'd made in intelligence had left no mark on their appearance or their surroundings. Durham said, "They're communicating a version of the theory, and actively demonstrating the underlying mathematics at the same time, like one group of researchers sending a computer model to another. But the Lambertians don't have artificial computers. If the dance looks valid, it's taken up by other groups, and if they sustain it long enough, they'll internalize the pattern. They'll be able to remember it without continuing to perform it." Peer whispered, "Come back to the workshop and dance cosmological models with me?" Kate ignored him. "The dominant theory employs accurate knowledge of autoverse chemistry and physics, and includes a detailed breakdown of the composition of the primordial cloud. It goes no further. As yet, there's no hypothesis about the way in which that particular cloud might have come into existence. No explanation for the origin and relative abundances of the elements. And there can be no explanation, no sensible prior history. The autoverse doesn't provide one. No Big Bang. General relativity doesn't apply. Their space-time is flat. Their universe isn't expanding. No elements formed in stars. There are no nuclear forces. No fusion. Stars burn by gravity alone, and their sun is the only star. So these cosmologists are about to hit a brick wall, through no fault of their own. Dominic Repetto has suggested that now would be the ideal time for us to make contact with the Lambertians, to announce our presence, to explain their planet's origins, to begin a carefully moderated cultural exchange." A soft murmuring broke out among the crowd. Peer turned to Kate. "This is it? This is the news I couldn't miss?" She stared back at him pityingly. "They're talking about first contact with an alien race. Do you really want to sleepwalk right through that?" Peer laughed. "First contact? They've observed these insects in microscopic detail since the days they were single-celled algae. Everything about them is known already. Their biology, their language, their culture. It's all in the central library. These aliens have evolved on a microscope slide. There are no surprises in store."
"Except how they respond to us."
"Us? Nobody responds to us." Kate gave him a poisonous look.
"How they respond to the Elysians."
Peer thought it over. "I expect someone knows all about that, too. Someone must have modeled the reaction of Lambertian society to finding out that they're nothing but an experiment in artificial life." An Elysian presenting as a tall, thin young man took the stage. Durham introduced him as Dominic Repetto. Peer had given up trying to keep track of the proliferating dynasties long ago, but he thought the name was a recent addition. He certainly couldn't recall a Repetto being involved in autoverse studies when he'd had a passion for the subject himself. Repetto addressed the meeting.
"It's my belief that the Lambertians now possess the conceptual framework they need to comprehend our existence and to make sense of our role in their cosmology. It's true that they lack artificial computers, but their whole language of ideas is based on representations of the world around them in the form of numerical models. These models were originally variations on a few genetically hardwired themes, maps of terrain showing food sources, algorithms for predicting predator behavior, but the modern Lambertians have evolved the skill of generating and testing whole new classes of models in a way that's as innate to them as language skills were to the earliest humans. A team of Lambertians can speak and judge a mathematical description of population dynamics in the mites they herd for food as easily as pre-launch humans could construct or comprehend a simple sentence. We mustn't judge them by anthropomorphic standards. Human technological landmarks simply aren't relevant. The Lambertians have deduced most of Autoverse chemistry and physics by observations of their natural world, supplemented by a very small number of controlled experiments. They've generated concepts equivalent to temperature and pressure, energy and entropy, without fire, metallurgy, or the wheel, let alone the steam engine. They've calculated the melting and boiling points of most of the elements without ever purifying them. Their lack of technology only makes their intellectual achievements all the more astounding. It's as if the ancient Greeks had written about the boiling point of nitrogen, or the Egyptians had predicted the chemical properties of chlorine.
Piers smiled to himself cynically. The Founders always loved to hear Earth rate a mention, and all the better if the references were to times long before they were born. Repetto paused. He grew perceptibly taller, and his youthful features became subtly more dignified, more mature. Most Elysians would see this as no more manipulative than a change in posture or tone of voice. He said solemnly,
"Most of you will be aware of the resolution of the town meeting of January 5th, 3052, forbidding contact with the Lambertians until they'd constructed their own computers and performed simulations, experiments in artificial life, as sophisticated as the Autoverse itself. That was judged to be the safest possible benchmark, but I believe it has turned out to be misconceived and completely inappropriate. The Lambertians are looking for answers to questions about their origins. We know there are no answers to be discovered inside the Autoverse itself, but I believe the Lambertians are intellectually equipped to comprehend the larger truth. We have a responsibility to make that truth known to them. I propose that this meeting overturns the resolution of 3052 and authorizes a team of Autoverse scholars to enter planet Lambert and, in a culturally sensitive manner, inform the Lambertians of their history and context."
The buzz of discussion grew louder. Pierre felt a vestigial twinge of interest in spite of himself. In a universe without death or scarcity, politics took strange forms. Any one of the Founders who disagreed with the way planet Lambert was managed would be perfectly free to copy the whole Autoverse into their own territory, and to do as they wished with their own private version. In inverse proportion to the ease of such a move, any faction would have a rare chance here to demonstrate their influence and increase their prestige by persuading the meeting to retain the ban on contact with the Lambertians, without provoking their opponents into cloning the Autoverse and pushing ahead regardless. Many of the first generation still chose to value these things, for their own sake. Elaine Sanderson rose to her feet, resplendent in a light blue suit and a body which together proclaimed 1972 to 2045 A.D., and proud of it, even if she only wore them on official occasions. Pierre let himself time-trip for a second. In his late teens, David Hawthorne had seen the flesh-and-blood Sanderson on television, being sworn in as Attorney General of the United States of America, a nation whose constituent particles at the time of that oath might well overlap with some portion of Elysium at this very instant. Sanderson said,
"Thank you, Mr. Repetto, for giving us your perspective on this important matter. It's unfortunate that so few of us take the time to keep ourselves up to date with the progress of the Lambertians. Although they have come all the way from single-celled life forms to their present highly sophisticated state without our explicit intervention, ultimately they are in our care at every moment, and we all have a duty to treat that responsibility with the utmost seriousness. I can still recall some of the earliest plans we made for dealing with the Autoverse.
to hide the details of life on planet Lambert from ourselves deliberately, to watch and wait, as if from afar, until the inhabitants sent probes to their system's other worlds, to arrive as explorers in spaceships, struggling to learn the language and customs of these aliens, perhaps going so far as to extend the Autoverse to include an invisibly distant star, with a home world from which we might travel. Slavish imitations of the hypothetical interstellar missions we'd left behind. Bizarre charades. Mercifully, we abandoned those childish ideas long ago. There will be no sham mission of discovery, and no lying to the Lambertians or to ourselves. There is one quality of those early laughable schemes which should still be kept in mind, though. We always intended to meet the Lambertians as equals. Visitors from a distant world who would stretch their vision of the universe, but not subvert it, not swallow it whole. We would approach them as siblings, arguing our viewpoint, not gods revealing divine truth. I asked the meeting to consider whether these two equally laudable aims of honesty and humility could not be reconciled. If the Lambertians are on the verge of a crisis in understanding their origins, what patronizing instinct compels us to rush in and provide them with an instant solution? Mr. Repetto tells us how they have already inferred the properties of the chemical elements, elements which remain mysterious and invisible, manifesting themselves only in the elaborate phenomena of the natural world. Clearly, the Lambertians have a gift for uncovering hidden patterns, hidden explanations. How many more centuries can it be, then, before they guess the truth about their own cosmology? I propose that we delay contact until the hypothesis of our existence has arisen naturally amongst the Lambertians and has been thoroughly explored, until they have decided for themselves exactly what we might mean to them, until they have debated, as we are debating right now, how best they might deal with us. If aliens had visited Earth the moment humans first looked up at the sky and suffered some crisis of understanding, they would have been hailed as gods. If they'd arrived in the early 21st century, when humans had been predicting their existence and pondering the logistics of contact for decades, they would have been accepted as equals, more experienced, more skilled, more knowledgeable, but ultimately nothing but an expected part of a well-behaved, well-understood universe. I believe that we should wait for the equivalent moment in Lambertian history, when the Lambertians are impatient for proof of our existence, when our continued absence becomes far harder for them to explain than our arrival would be, once they begin to suspect that we're eavesdropping on every conversation they hold about us. It would be dishonest to remain concealed. Until then, we owe them the opportunity to find as many answers as they can without us.
Sanderson resumed her seat. Portions of the audience applauded demurely. Peer lazily mapped the response and correlated it with appearance. She seemed to have been a big hit with the third-generation mainstream, but they had a reputation for gleefully faking everything. Kate said,
"Don't you wish you could join the discussion?"
Half sarcasm, half self-pity. Pierce said cheerfully,
"No, but if you have strong views on the matter yourself, I suggest you copy the whole Autoverse and make contact with the Lambertians personally, or leave them in unspoilt ignorance, whichever you prefer."
"You know I don't have room to do that."
"And you know that makes no difference. There's a copy of the original biosphere seed, the entire compressed description, in the central library. You could copy that, and freeze yourself until you finally have the room to unfold it. The whole thing's deterministic. Every Lambertian would flutter its little wings for you in exactly the same way as it did for the Elysians, right up to the moment of contact."
"And you honestly believe that the city will grow that large? That after a billion years of standard time, they won't have trashed it and built something new?"
I don't know, but there's always the alternative. You could launch a whole new TBC universe and make all the room you need. I'll come along if you want me to. He meant it. He'd follow her anywhere. She only had to say the word. But she looked away. He ached to grant her happiness, but the choice was hers. If she wanted to believe that she was standing outside in the snow, or rather, bricked into the walls, watching the Elysians feast on reality, there was nothing he could do to change that. 307 speakers followed. 162 backed Repetto. 140 supported Sanderson. 5 waffled on with no apparent agenda, a remarkably low proportion. Peer daydreamed about the sound of sandpaper on wood. When the vote finally came, 1 per original attendee, no last-minute clonings accepted. Sanderson won by a 10% margin. She took the stage and made a short speech, thanking the voters for their decision. Peers suspected that many of the Elysians had quietly slipped out of their bodies and gone elsewhere by now. Dominic Repetto said a few words too, clearly disappointed, but gracious in defeat. It was Paul Durham, presumably his mentor and sponsor, who showed the slightly vacuous expression of a model of a body with its facial muscles crudely decoupled from its model of a brain. Durham, with his strange history of brief episodes as a copy in different permutations, seemed to have never really caught up with the pre-launch state of the art, let alone the Elysian cunning edge. When he had something to hide, it was obvious. He was taking the decision badly. Kate said coldly, "That's it. You fulfilled your civic duty. You can go now." Pierre made his eyes big and brown. "Come back to the workshop with me. We can make love in the wood dust, or just sit around and talk. Be happy for no reason. It wouldn't be so bad." Kate shook her head and faded away. Pierre felt a pang of disappointment, but not for long. There'd be other times. Chapter 25. Thomas crouched in the bathroom window frame, halfway out of Anna's flat. He knew that the edges of the brickwork would be sharper than razors this time. He made his way across to the neighbor's window, repeating the familiar movements precisely, though his hands and forearms wept blood. Insects crawled from the wounds and swarmed along his arms, over his face, into his mouth. He gagged and retched, but he didn't falter. Down the drainpipe. From the alley below, he returned to the flat. Anna was by his side on the stairs. They danced again. Argued again. Struggled again. "Think fast, think fast." He knelt over her, one knee to either side, took her face in his hands, then closed his eyes. He brought her head forward, then slammed it back against the wall, 5 times. Then he held his fingers near her nostrils without opening his eyes. He felt no exhalation. Thomas was in his Frankfurt apartment, a month after the murder, dreaming. Anna stood by the bed. He reached out from beneath the blankets into the darkness, eyes closed. She took his hand in hers. With her other hand, she stroked the scar on his forearm tenderly. Then she pushed one finger easily through his brittle skin and liquefying flesh. He thrashed against the sheets, but she wouldn't let go. She dug with her fingers until she was gripping naked bone. When she snapped the ulna and radius, he convulsed with pain and ejaculated suddenly, everything his corrupt body contained departing in a single stream. Dark clotted blood, maggots, pus, excrement. Thomas was in his suburban mansion, sitting naked on the floor at the end of a hallway, startled. He shifted his right hand and realized that he was clutching a small vegetable knife, and he remembered why. There were 7 faint pink scars on his abdomen, 7 digits, still legible, right way up as he gazed down at them. 1, 0, 5, 3901. He set to work re-carving the first six. He didn't trust the clocks. The clocks lied. And although every incision he made in his skin healed perfectly, given time, for a long time it seemed he had managed to repair the numbers before they faded. He didn't know what they measured, except their own steady ascent, but they seemed like a touchstone of something approaching sanity. He recut the final digit as a 2, then licked his fingers and wiped the blood away. At first it seeped back, but after 5 or 6 repetitions, the fresh wound stood clean and red against his pale skin. He pronounced the number several times.
1,053,902.
Thomas climbed to his feet and walked down the hall. His body knew only the time he carved upon it. He never felt tired or hungry, or even unclean. He could sleep or not sleep, eat or not eat, wash or not wash. It made no perceptible difference. His hair and fingernails never grew. His face never aged. He stopped outside the library. He believed he'd methodically torn all the books to shreds several times. But on each occasion, the debris had been cleared away and the books replaced in his absence. He walked into the room. He glanced at the terminal in the corner, the object of his deepest loathing. He'd never been able to damage it, smash, chip, bend, or even scratch any part of its visible form. Indestructible or not, it had never functioned. He wandered from shelf to shelf, but he'd read every book a dozen or more times. They'd all become meaningless. The library was well stocked, and he'd studied the sacred texts of every faith, those few which, by some stretch of poetic license, might have been said to describe his condition, offered no prospect for changing it. In the distant past, he'd undergone 100 feverish conversions. He'd ranted to every deity which humanity had ever postulated. If he'd stumbled on the one which existed, the one responsible for his damnation, his pleas had been to no avail. The one thing he'd never expected after death was uncertainty. It had worried him deeply at first, being cast into hell without so much as a glimpse of heaven to taunt him, and a smug "I told you so" from the faithful on their way up, let alone a formal trial before the God of his childhood, in which every doctrinal assertion he'd ever doubted was proclaimed as absolute truth, and every theological debate was resolved once and for all. But he'd since decided that if his condition was eternal and irreversible, it hardly mattered what the God who'd made it so was named. Thomas sat cross-legged on the floor of the library and tried to empty his mind.
Think fast. Think fast.
Anna lay before him bleeding and unconscious. Time slowed down. The moment he was approaching seemed impossible to face, impossible to traverse yet again. But he inched towards it, and he knew that he had no power to turn away. He'd come to understand that all the visions of his own decay and mutilation were nothing but elaborate gestures of self-loathing. When his flesh was torn from his body, it was a distraction, almost a relief. His suffering did not illuminate his crime. It drowned his thoughts in an anesthetic haze. It was a fantasy of power, a fantasy of retribution. But here there was no balm of self-righteous pain, no pretense that his baroque tortures were working some alchemy of justice. He knelt over Anna, and could not weep, could not flinch, could not blind himself to the measure of what he'd done. He might have called an ambulance. He might have saved her life. It would have taken so little strength, so little courage, so little love, that he could not imagine how a human being could have failed to possess enough of each and still walk the earth. But he had. He had. So he brought her head forward and slammed it against the wall. Chapter 26. After a week as Durham's guest, Maria went looking for a place of her own. Her anger had faded. The numbness of shock had faded. The fifth or sixth wave of disbelief had finally lifted. But she still felt almost paralyzed by the strangeness of the truths she'd been forced to accept. Her exile from the universe of flesh and blood humanity, the impossible existence of Elysium, intelligent life in the Autoverse. She couldn't begin to make sense of any of these things until she had a fixed point to stand on. She had refused to pack any luggage to accompany her scan file into the next life. It would have felt like she was humoring Durham if she'd made the slightest concession to the needs of a copy who she'd believed would never run. No environments, no furniture, no clothes, no photographs, no diaries, no scanned memorabilia, no VR duplicate of her old narrow terrace to make her feel at home. She might have set about reconstructing it from memory, detail by detail, or let architectural software pluck a perfect imitation straight out of her brain, but she didn't feel strong enough to deal with the emotional contradictions. The tug of the old world, the taint of self-deception. Instead, she decided to choose one of the predefined apartments in the city itself. Durham assured her that nobody would begrudge her the use of public resources. Of course you could copy the city into your own territory and run a private version at your own expense, defeating the whole point. This is the one environment in all of Elysium which comes close to being a place in the old sense. Anyone can walk the streets, anyone can live here, but no one can rearrange the skyline on a whim. It would require a far more impassioned debate to alter the colors of the street signs here than it used to take for the average local council to rezone an entire neighborhood. So Permutation City offered her its disingenuous, municipally sanctioned, quasi-objective presence for free, while her model of a body ran on processors in her own territory, and the two systems, by exchanging data, contrived her experience of walking the streets, entering the sleek metallic buildings, and exploring the empty apartments which might have smelt of paint, but didn't. She felt nervous on her own, so Durham came with her, solicitous and apologetic as ever. His regret seemed sincere on one level. He wasn't indifferent to the pain he'd caused her, but beneath that there didn't seem to be much doubt. He clearly expected to be wholly forgiven for waking her sooner or later. She asked him, "How does it feel being 7,000 years old?" "That depends." "On what?" "On how I want it to feel." She found a place in the northeast quadrant, halfway between the central tower and the city's rim. From the bedroom she could see the mountains in the east, the glistening waterfall, a distant patch of forest. There were better views available, but this one seemed right. Anything more spectacular would have made her feel self-conscious. Durham showed her how to claim residency. A brief dialogue with the apartment software. He said, "You're the only Elysian in this tower, so you can program all your neighbors any way you like." "What if I do nothing?" "Default behavior. They'll stay out of your way." "And what about other Elysians? Am I such a novelty that people will come looking for me?" Durham thought it over. "Your awakening is public knowledge, but most people here are fairly patient. I doubt that anyone would be so rude as to buttonhole you in the street. Your phone number will remain unlisted until you choose otherwise, and the apartment itself is under your control now, as secure as any private environment. The software has been rigorously validated. Breaking and entering is mathematically impossible." He left her to settle in. She paced the rooms, trying to inhabit them, to claim them as her own. She forced herself to walk the nearby streets, trying to feel at ease. The Art Deco apartment, the Fritz Lang towers, the streets full of crowd scene extras, all unnerved her, but on reflection, she realized that she couldn't have gone anywhere else. when she tried to imagine her territory, her private slice of Elysium, it seemed as daunting and unmanageable as if she'd inherited 1/24th of the old universe of galaxies in vacuum. That the new one was generally invisible and built from a lattice of self-reproducing computers, built in turn from cellular automaton cells, which were nothing more than sequences of numbers, however easy it might be to color-code them and arrange them in neat grids, only made the thought of being lost in its vastness infinitely stranger. It was bad enough that her true body was a pattern of computation resonating in a tiny portion of an otherwise silent crystalline pyramid, which stretched into the distance for the TVC equivalent of thousands of light-years. The thought of immersing her senses in a fake world which was really another corner of the same structure, withdrawing entirely into the darkness of that giant airless crypt, and surrendering to private hallucinations, made her sick with panic. If the city was equally unreal, at least it was one hallucination which other Elysians shared, and anchored by that consensus, she found the courage to examine the invisible world beneath from a safe, if hallucinatory, distance. She sat in the apartment and studied maps of Elysium. On the largest scale, most of the cube was portrayed as featureless. The other 17 Founders' pyramids were private, and her own was all but unused. Public territory could be colored according to the software it ran, processes identified, data flows traced, but even then, most of it was monochrome. 5 of the 6 public pyramids were devoted to the Autoverse, running the same simple program on processor after processor, implementing the Autoverse's own cellular automaton rules, utterly different from the TVC's. A faint metallic grid was superimposed on this region, like a mesh of fine wires immersed in an unknown substance to gauge its properties. This was the software which spied on Planet Lambert, an entirely separate program from the Autoverse itself, not subject to any of its laws. Maria had written the original version herself, although she'd never had a chance to test it on a planetary scale. Generations of Elysian Autoverse scholars had extended and refined it, and now it peeked through a quadrillion non-existent cracks in space, collating, interpreting, and summarizing everything it saw. The results flowed to the hub of Elysium, into the central library, along a channel rendered luminous as white-hot silver by the density of its data flow. The hub itself was a dazzling polyhedron, a cluster of databases ringed by the communication structures which handled the torrent of information flowing to and from the pyramids. Every transaction between Elysians of different clans flowed through here, from phone calls to handshakes, from sex to whatever elaborate post-human intimacies they'd invented in the past 7,000 years. The map gave nothing away, though, even with the highest magnification and the slowest replay, streaming packets of data registered as nothing more than featureless points of light, their contents safely anonymous. The second brightest data flow linked the hub to the city, revealed as a delicate labyrinth of algorithms, clinging to one face of the 6th public pyramid. With the Autoverse software across the border rendered midnight blue, the city looked like a cluttered neo-lit fairground on the edge of a vast desert at the end of a shimmering highway. Maria zoomed in and watched the packets of data responsible for the map itself come streaming out from the hub. There was no point-for-point correspondence between this view and the city of the senses. The crowds of fake pedestrians spread across the visible metropolis could all be found here as a tight assembly of tiny flashing blocks in pastel shades, with titles like Flocking Behavior and Miscellaneous Tropisms. The locations and other attributes of specific individuals were encoded in data structures too small to be seen without relentless magnification. Maria's own apartment was equally microscopic, but it was the product of widely scattered components as far apart as surface optics, aerodynamics, thermal radiation, and carpet texture. She might have viewed her own body as a similar diagram of functional modules, but she decided to let that wait. One vivisection at a time. She began exploring the information resources of Elysium, the data networks which portrayed themselves as such, and leaving the apartment to walk alone through the city twice a day, familiarizing herself with the two spaces analogous to those she'd known in the past. She skimmed through the libraries not quite at random, flicking through Homer and Joyce, staring at the Rembrandts and Picassos and Moores, playing snatches of Chopin and Liszt, viewing scenes from Bergman and Buñuel, hefting the weight of the kernel of human civilization the Elysians had brought with them. It felt light. Dubliners was as fantastic now as the Iliad. Guernica had never really happened, or if it had, the Elysian view was beyond the powers of any artist to portray. The Seventh Seal was a mad, pointless fairy tale. The discreet charm of the bourgeoisie was all that remained. Altering herself in any way was too hard a decision to make, so faithful by default to human physiology, she ate and shat and slept. There were a thousand ways to conjure food into existence, from gourmet meals in the culinary database literally emerging from the screen of her terminal, to the time-saving option of push-button satiety and a pleasant aftertaste, but old rituals clamored to be reenacted. So she went out and bought raw ingredients from puppet shopkeepers and aromatic delicatessens, and cooked her own meals, often badly, and grew curiously tired watching the imperfect chemistry at work, as if she was performing the difficult simulation subconsciously herself. For 3 nights, she dreamt that she was back in the old world, having unremarkable conversations with her parents, school friends, fellow Autoverse junkies, old lovers. Whatever the scene, the air was charged, glowing with self-conscious authenticity. She woke from these dreams crippled with loss, clawing at the retreating certainties, believing, for 10 seconds or 5, that Durham had drugged her, hypnotized her, brainwashed her into dreaming of Elysium, and each time she thought she slept here, she awoke into the earthly life she'd never stopped living. Then the fog cleared from her brain, and she knew that it wasn't true. She dreamt of the city for the first time. She was out on 15th Avenue when the puppet started pleading with her to be treated as fully sentient.
"We pass the Turing test, don't we? Is a stranger in a crowd less than human just because you can't witness her inner life?"
They tugged at her clothes like beggars. She told them not to be absurd. She said, "How can you complain? Don't you understand? We've abolished injustice." A man in a crisp black suit eyed her sharply and muttered, "You'll always have the poor." But he was wrong. And she dreamt of Elysium itself. She weaved her way through the TVC grid and the gaps between the processors, transformed into a simple, self-sustaining pattern of cells, like the oldest, most primitive forms of artificial life, disturbing nothing, but observing everything, in all 6 dimensions, no less. She woke when she realized how absurd that was. The TVC universe wasn't flooded with some analog of light, spreading information about every cell far and wide. To be embedded in the grid meant being all but blind to its contents, reaching out and painstakingly probing what lay ahead, sometimes destructively, was the only way to discover anything. In the late afternoons, in the golden light which flooded in through the bedroom window after 1,000 chance calculated reflections between the towers, she usually wept. It felt inadequate, desultory, pathetic, immoral. She didn't want to mourn the human race, but she didn't know how to make sense of its absence. She refused to imagine a world long dead, as if her Elysian millennia of sleep had propelled her into Earth's uncertain future, so she struggled to bind herself to the time she remembered, to follow the life of her doppelganger in her mind. She pictured a reconciliation with Aiden. It wasn't impossible. She pictured him very much alive, as tender and selfish and stubborn as ever. She fantasized the most mundane, the most unexceptionable moments between them, ruthlessly weeding out anything that seemed too optimistic, too much like wish fulfillment. She wasn't interested in inventing a perfect life for the other Maria. She only wanted to guess the unknowable truth. But she had to keep believing that she'd saved Francesca. Anything less would have been unbearable. She tried to think of herself as an immigrant, an ocean crosser in the days before aircraft, before telegraphs. People had left everything behind and survived, prospered, flourished. Their lives hadn't been destroyed. They'd embraced the unknown and been enriched, transformed. The unknown. She was living in an artifact, a mathematical object she'd helped Durham construct for his billionaires. Elysium was a universe made to order. It contained no hidden wonders, no lost tribes. But it did contain the Autoverse. The longer she thought about it, the more it seemed that Planet Lambert was the key to her sanity. Even after 3 billion years of evolution, it was the one thing in Elysium which connected with her past life, leading right back to the night she'd witnessed A. Lamberti digesting Mutos. The thread was unbroken. The seed organism, A. hydrophila, had come from that very same strain. And if the Autoverse then had been the ultimate indulgence, a rarefied intellectual game in a world beset with problems, the situation now was completely inverted. The Autoverse was home to hundreds of millions of life forms, a flourishing civilization, a culture on the verge of a scientific revolution. In a universe subject to whim, convenience, and fantasy, it seemed like the only solid ground left. And although she suffered no delusions of having personally created the Lambertians, sketching their planet's early history, and cobbling together an ancestor for them by adapting someone else's translation of a terrestrial bacterium, hardly qualified her to take credit for their multiplex nervous systems and their open-air digestive tracts, let alone their self-awareness. She couldn't simply wash her hands of their fate. She'd never believed that Planet Lambert could be brought into existence, but she had helped to make it happen nonetheless. Part of her still wanted to do nothing but rage against her awakening and mourn her loss. Embracing the Autoverse seemed like an insult to the memory of Earth, and a sign that she'd accepted the way Durham had treated her. But it began to seem perverse to the point of insanity to turn her back on the one thing which might give her new life some meaning, just to spite Durham, just to make a lie of his reasons for waking her. There were other ways of making it clear that she hadn't forgiven him. The apartment at first, inconceivably large, almost uninhabitable, slowly lost its strangeness. On the 10th morning, she finally woke, expecting the sight of the bedroom exactly as she found it, if not at peace with her situation, at least unsurprised to be exactly where she was. She phoned Durham and said, "I want to join the expedition." The contact group occupied one story of a tower in the southeast quadrant. Maria, uninterested in teleporting, made the journey on foot, crossing from building to building by walkway, ignoring the puppets and admiring the view. It was faster than traveling at street level, and she was gradually conquering her fear of heights. Bridges here did not collapse from unanticipated vibrations. Perspex tubes did not hurtle to the ground, spilling corpses onto the pavement. It made no difference whether or not Malcolm Carter had known the first thing about structural engineering. The city was hardly going to bother laboriously modeling stresses and loads just to discover whether or not parts of itself should fail, for the sake of realism. Everything was perfectly safe, by decree. Durham was waiting for her in the foyer. Inside, he introduced her to Dominic Repetto and Alyssa Zemanski, the project's other leaders. Maria hadn't known what to expect from her first contact with later-generation Elysians, but they presented as neatly dressed humans, male and female, both in their late 30s, wearing clothes which would not have looked wildly out of place in any office in 21st century Sydney. Out of deference to her? She hoped not, unless the accepted thing to do in their subculture was to show a different form to everyone, expressly designed to put them at ease. Repetto, in fact, was so strikingly handsome that she almost recoiled at the thought that he, or his parent, had deliberately chosen such a face. But what did codes of vanity from the age of cosmetic surgery and gene splicing mean now? Zemanski was stunning, too, with dark-flecked violet eyes and spiked blonde hair. Durham appeared to her, at least, almost unchanged from the man she'd met in 2050. Maria began to wonder how she looked to the young Elysians, like something recently disinterred, probably. Repetto shook her hand over and over.
"It's a great, great honor to meet you. I can't tell you how much you've inspired us all."
His face shone. He seemed to be sincere. Maria felt her cheeks flush and tried to imagine herself in some analogous situation, shaking hands with who? Max Lambert? John Van Neumann? Alan Turing? Charles Babbage? Ada Lovelace? She knew she'd done nothing compared to any of those pioneers, but she'd had 7,000 years for her reputation to be embellished, and 3 billion for her work to bear fruit. The floor was divided into open-plan offices, but nobody else seemed to be about. Durham saw her peering around the partitions and said cryptically, "There are other workers, but they come and go." Zemanski led the way into a small conference room. She said to Maria,
"We can move to a VR representation of Planet Lambert, if you like, but I should warn you that it can be disorienting, being visually immersed but intangible, walking through vegetation, and so on. And moving at the kind of speeds necessary to keep track of the Lambertians can induce motion sickness. Of course, there are neural changes which counteract both those problems."
Maria wasn't ready to start tampering with her brain, or to step onto the surface of an alien planet. She said,
"Viewing screens sound easier. I'd be happier with that. Do you mind?"
Zemanski looked relieved. Repetto stood at the end of the table and addressed the three of them, although Maria knew this was all for her benefit.
"So much has been happening on Lambert lately that we've slowed it right down compared to standard time so we can keep up with developments."
An elliptical map of the planet's surface appeared on the wall behind him.
"Most recently, dozens of independent teams of chemists have begun looking for a simpler, more unified model underlying the current atomic theory."
Markers appeared, scattered across the map.
"It's been 300 years since the standard model, 32 atoms with a regular pattern of masses, valencies, and mutual affinities, became widely accepted. The Lambertian equivalent of Mendeleev's periodic table."
He flashed a smile at Maria, as if she might have been a contemporary of Mendeleev, or perhaps because he was proud of his arcane knowledge of the history of a science which was no longer true.
"At the time, atoms were accepted as fundamental entities, structureless, indivisible, requiring no further explanation. Over the last 20 years, that view has finally begun to break down."
Maria was already confused. From the hurried reading she'd done in the past few days, she knew that the Lambertians only modified an established theory when a new phenomenon was discovered which the theory failed to explain. Repetto must have noticed her expression, because he paused expectantly. She said,
Autoverse atoms are indivisible. There are no components you can separate out, no smaller stable entities. Smash them together at any energy you like, and all they'll do is bounce, and the Lambertians are in no position to smash them together at any energy at all. So surely there's nothing in their experience that the current theory can't account for perfectly.
Nothing in their immediate environment, certainly. But the problem is cosmology. They've been refining the models of the history of their star system, and now they're looking for an explanation for the composition of the primordial cloud.
They accepted the 32 atoms and their properties as given, but they can't bring themselves to do the same with the arbitrary amounts of each one in the cloud?
That's right. It's difficult to translate the motivation exactly, but they have a very precise aesthetic which dictates what they'll accept as a theory, and it's almost physically impossible for them to contradict it. If they try to dance a theory which fails to resonate with the neural system which assesses its simplicity, the dance falls apart.
He thought for a second, then pointed to the screen behind him. A swarm of Lambertians appeared.
Here's an example. Going back a while, this is a team of astronomers, all fully aware of the motions of the planets in the sky, relative to the sun, testing out a theory which attempts to explain those observations by assuming that planet Lambert is fixed, and everything else orbits around it.
Maria watched the creatures intently. She would have been hard-pressed to identify the rhythms in their elaborate weaving motions. But when the swarm began to drift apart, the collapse of order was obvious.
Now, here's the heliocentric version, from a few years later.
The dance again was too complex to analyze, although it did seem to be more harmonious, and after a while, almost hypnotic. The black speck shifting back and forth against the white sky left trails on her retinas. Below the ubiquitous grassland seemed an odd setting for astronomical theorizing. The Lambertians apparently accepted their condition, in which herding mites represented the greatest control they exerted over nature, as if it constituted as much of a utopia as the Elysian's total freedom. They still faced predators. Many still died young from disease. Food was always plentiful, though. They'd modeled their own population cycles and learnt to damp the oscillations at a very early stage. And nature lovers or not, there'd been no ideological struggles over birth control. Once the population model had spread, the same remedies had been adopted by communities right across the planet. Lambertian cultural diversity was limited. Far more behavior was genetically determined than was the case in humans, the young being born self-sufficient, with far less neural plasticity than a human infant, and there was relatively little variation in the relevant genes. The heliocentric theory was acceptable. The dance remained coherent. Repetto replayed the scene, with a translation in a small window showing the positions of the planets represented at each moment. Maria still couldn't decipher the correspondence. The Lambertians certainly weren't flying around in simple mimicry of the hypothetical orbits. But the synchronized rhythms of planets and insect astronomers seemed to mesh somewhere in her visual cortex, firing some pattern detector which didn't know quite what to make of the strange resonance. She said,
"So Ptolemy was simply bad grammar, obvious nonsense. Double plus ungood. And they reached Copernicus a few years later? That's impressive. How long did they take to get to Kepler, to Newton?"
Szymanski said smoothly,
"That was Newton. The theory of gravity and the laws of motion were all part of the model they were dancing. The Lambertians could never have expressed the shapes of the orbits without including a reason for them."
Maria felt the hairs rise on the back of her neck.
If that was Newton, what came before?
Nothing. That was the first successful astronomical model, the culmination of about a decade of trial.